So Nia, the Makba as it happens.
Natalie Jeremijenko is an artist and engineer. She is associate professor in the visual arts department at New York University and director of the Environmental Health Clinic, a para-institutional project geared towards improving human and environmental health and quality of life. Her expertise in a wide range of fields, from biochemistry to technology and visual arts, allows her to probe infrastructures that tangibly improve air pollution, soil diversity, and promote public space innovation. Jeremijenko has shaped an understanding of the planet as a profuse web of cooperative links. Her projects question assumptions such as the logic of responsible consumption, in which minimizing environmental impact comes second to boosting mutual benefits. Sunia talks to Natalie Jeremijenko about learning by living together, about the vitality and shortcomings of the environmental struggles of the past, and about how to imagine our relationships with natural systems from this point on.
The good news about the end of environmental regulation, I think there is good news, is that regulation is not the only, and arguably not the best, way to redesign our relationship to natural systems. But this question of how does anyone take on these kind of complex social and political and environmental issues, that what I call the crisis of agency? What do I do as an individual, as a institution, as a family, as a school group, as a community group? What do I do? What can I do? I mean, it's overwhelming. And I mean, scoping things in time and in space is really part of that. So it resists the globalized discourse, right? It's like global warming, global biodiversity loss. That global discourse, you can do nothing about global warming. But you can do something about your indoor air quality, your local food systems, your soil biodiversity, these small scale phenomena that affect you and your kid sister and your grandparents. And I do that through health.
The best proxy for the common good.
In the irreducible complexity of an urban ecosystem, where you have a lot of people who are environmentalists and a lot of them who are entrepreneurs and want to build some new app, and you have pro-development and anti-development and left and far left and right, and you have all of these polarizations that make the mess and contested kind of actuality of a city, right, or a shared space. But you don't have anyone who's anti-health. And so by framing, using health, which is measurable in terms of, how many children have asthma and the hospitalization rate of asthma or cardiovascular health, or, framing it in measurable, non-controversial ways, I would argue it's the best proxy for the common good. And being able to say then that anything goes if it measurably improves human and environmental health. We can do anything, right? So it opens up the kind of design, spectacle, play, away from the kind of regulatory, kind of you must do a green roof and you must do it in this way that doesn't water, and that idea that you can program the wild imagination of, that is, I would argue, our biggest cultural resource. So I rail against the regulatory kind of strong left idea that you can make the right protections defensive. And, I want to create spaces and places where we can access creative agency. I'd argue that institutional critique is the biggest intellectual contribution of 20th century contemporary art practice, contemporary conceptual art practice. I think that the idea that we can transcend the gesture and the intervention and the site-specific temporal installation, that, these kind of gestural moments, the happening, right, into durable social and environmental change, right, which requires the institutionalized relationships. which is why I developed the Environmental Health Clinic as a framework, and ooze, zoo backwards and without cages, to create urban habitats for non-humans. The Environmental Health Clinic is clearly a critique of health and how we think of as health as medicalized and pharmaceutical, as opposed to in the air quality in this room, in the food systems and shared water systems, and in the shared external environment. We can change our food systems. We can change our the number one human health issue that dominates all of us, right? Our lifespan is better predicted by how close we live to a major arterial road than by any genetic marker. So air quality, implicated in the breast cancer epidemic, in the obesity epidemic, in diabetes, even in, obviously, in the cardiovascular and respiratory-related issues. Air quality is this huge cultural challenge, right? Because it used to be the case that, again, in environmental regulation and the environmental world, you would sue the big bad polluters, right? The deep pockets. But now we're in a radically different historic moment where the biggest pollution source, the biggest threat to human health, is in our air commons. And it's every one of us, right? It's the transportation choices of each one of us. It's our power systems. There's no, who do you point to sue, right? So we need radically different strategies for transforming. It's not punitive. It's not fighting. In the US, there's a big movement, probably the most successful movement in student world, called the Divestment Campaign, to force universities with their big endowments to divest from fossil fuel investments. And that's another example of these students having to meet with these, you know, the fund managers and say, we want you to divest, right, whatever. And it's been very successful. 300 universities and campuses have divested or pledged to divest from fossil fuels, and 200 other organizations, pension trusts and teachers associations and church groups and things. So, but that doesn't invite anybody into reimagining or redesigning a desirable future, right? That's, again, this kind of fighting the bad guys, which is why I get suicidal students, right? I get students every semester, once or twice. They come in, they're environmentalists, they print on both sides of the paper, they ride their bike or they walk, they don't own a car, they don't eat meat. But, you know, the best thing for them to do would be to suicide, because then they'll use less energy, their carbon footprint will be even less, right? And that's the logical extension of the conservation, preservation, you know, this idea that we are a burden on and in the world, that the responsible consumer movement, you know, you can buy your fair trade, Energy Star, you know, that you can, that purchasing power and political power can be conflated. Depressing, right? Because, of course, as a young student, by definition, you have no purchasing power. You know, you're not going to buy the Lexus hybrid or a Tesla, or, you know, you're not going to. And that whole responsible consumer that we're going to buy our way out of this gives us no capacity to think about what I can do that no one else can do. So in the Environmental Health Clinic, this idea starts with that crisis of what is it I can do? And like in a health clinic where, you know, you make your own appointment, it's a familiar social script, right? You understand that if you've got a sore knee, you're the only person who knows that, and you go and get it addressed and you access whatever expertise and support that. So similarly with the Environmental Health Clinic, if you've got a concern about air quality or food systems or water quality or energy systems, you can make an appointment and you come with your own concerns and we figure out how to co-produce some sort of prescription that's not to do with pharmaceuticals, but things you can actually do in your local neighborhood to improve human and environmental health.
Doctors Without Disciplinary Borders
So recently, I've started a new arm of the Environmental Health Clinic with a wonderful chemist, Cassandra Fraser from UVA, that I've called, she actually coined this, Doctors Without Disciplinary Borders. So this is a board of expertise, and I just opened an exhibition at Connecticut College called The Exhibition, which is really to take the clinic format, which is a one-on-one or one-on-a-couple, and it's very productive, but to take it into an exhibition form, where the exhibition is not a place where you're showing fait accompli, but a community organizing venue, right, for a time period. And I've developed a way of displaying and exhibiting projects that I've designed, because typically in participatory design processes, you have a little, you know, group charrette where a community will be involved in redesigning a park or a common facility. And if you've ever been to one of those, they're often very disappointing. Even though the political process of inclusion is good, most people don't have design expertise in radically transformed energy systems or waste systems, or, you know, they have a lot of trite, familiar kind of things. So people aren't necessarily good systems designers, but they're very good, non-experts are very good at recognizing what they like. And so instead of having a design charrette pretending there's no expertise involved in design, which I would argue there is, I've set up these whiteboards that are not whiteboards. They're clear. And so people can see this new peer, the peer-to-peer, that actually is about 10 to 100 times stronger than a conventional peer, 1,000 to 10,000 times less expensive. It generates clean energy with a bio-oscillator. It creates habitat for mussels and aquaculture. It distills, desalinates water. There's no rigid members. It can't come off and ram, become a ramming rod in a storm surge in these more extreme conditions. And they can point to that and say, yeah, we need a pier here. We need a boardwalk. You know, they can recognize what might be adapted to a local environment. And so in order to do that, you have to assemble some local expertise. And so the waste project that we're proposing needs local experts that we nominate and give them honorary doctorates as Doctors Without Disciplinary Borders, that are sometimes academics and sometimes a local maintenance worker who knows the system very well, and assemble this local expertise. Because locally, I mean, a professor at a university has nothing to do with designing their local university campus systems at all, right? None of us are really invited to reimagine or redesign our shared local infrastructure. And that's problematic. So we can't draw on the very expertise, the very human resource, the very imaginative, you know, human capital that we have locally to remake, reimagine our places. So by setting up and authorizing this advisory board of Doctors Without Disciplinary Borders as a kind of clinical emergency to come in and say, to work with the environmental health clinic and the inpatients and the local experts, to start really saying it's our cultural centers, our museums, our galleries, our campuses and universities. These are the places that we should be piloting, designing, implementing, testing, experimenting with new systems. Municipalities have a hard enough time, right, paying, you know, the idea that, you know, where is innovation supposed to come from? So this idea that we can take cultural centers and the exhibition as and universities and campuses and figure out how to draw on the local expertise to say it's not the job of corporate engineering firms to come in and design waste and energy systems and food systems and the whole kind of secret privatization of our shared infrastructure, that to radically redesign our relationship to natural systems and to design in such a way that I suppose the big idea of the 21st century, I think, is to redesign our relationship to natural systems through shared infrastructure. And the big idea that I'm promoting at the moment, I'm the only person saying it, but it makes sense to people, is that we can design infrastructure that it does more than reduce the negative impact, right? Reducing food miles, reducing petrochemical fertilizers, reducing pesticides. Everything that has animated the food movement and the environmental movement of the last 20 years, which is all good, right? It's all great, but radically insufficient, right? We have to design food systems, distribution systems, energy systems that improve air quality, that build soil, that increase biodiversity, right? This idea that that's what we're designing for, not this apologetic reducing our negative harm, which is that logic of the suicidal student, right? Do less, leave no trace, do not touch, as opposed to do something and make it good. Figure out how to remake, reimagine, and build a desirable future.
Health and technology as opportunities.
So there's a number of strategies that I think really do work. Well, I really hope work to focus on real concrete infrastructure. Because the thing about environmental issues is that it's a way to concretize. I cannot understand how you can do socially engaged practice that's not also about the material conditions of food, access to nutritious, affordable food. I mean, there's just no social justice issue that can be disambiguated from environmental justice issues, right? So the thing about focusing on the material, the shared material commons, is that you can avoid the political discourse that is so easy to brand or to polarize around. And that's, again, the strategy of using health as a way of not having to take on specific political discourse, and technology because it's politics by another means. I see technology as an opportunity for social change. And the skepticism that most environmentalists have, that there's no tech fixes here, I'm sympathetic with, because most technology is very resource intensive and is developed by and for military or corporate, you know, entities that are investing in it. But technology need not be that. It has all these unintended consequences that can be exploited. And the share economy and the transformations of energy systems, the transformation of shared physical infrastructure requires commitment to technologies. I focus on this idea of convivial learning, material public experiments, small-scale public experiments that enlist and raise the standards of evidence involved in public discourse, right? Because transitioning to different energy systems, most of the environmental world is, you know, we have solar and wind, and big solar and big wind have many of the same problems that big oil, coal, and gas have, right? The solar technology to produce solar panels is the same as it is, you know, silicon wafer production for computation. It is the most toxic industry we've yet created, and it's all done in China. And, you know, it's not the answer. The consolidation into big solar and big wind makes no sense. These are diffuse resources.
Tree cloud data.
What I'm launching here is a new project called Tree Cloud Data. And it's actually, I think, a good example of these combined strategies of convivial learning, public experiments, and raising standards of evidence. So the idea has evolved from the tree offices that I've been doing for a while. So these are offices and trees owned and operated by the tree. So the tree is the landlord, and the tree tweets you and tells you, you know, pay up, pay your rent. I'm not going anywhere till you pay your rent. This idea of giving voice to non-humans and extending rights discourse to non-humans. This makes sense, right? The idea, the Bolivian Rights of Mother Earth document, where you know, if a river has its own rights, you don't have to find some farmer whose livelihood has been affected by a mining company trashing the river and the thermal pollution of the incinerator here, for instance, killing. You know, you don't have to do this legal gymnastics to find the right person to represent the common good. If the river can sue on its own behalf, that has tremendous consequences, right? So this idea that rights extend beyond humans makes sense to a lot of us, and translating it into the tree office, you know, a hipster workspace where, again, it's the cultural challenge that we all face as we've changed our, we don't need to sit in a cubicle to get a phone call. We can sit in a tree and work. Why not, right? In the perfect weather of Barcelona, why wouldn't we sit in trees, right? And the tree office is not an enclosure. It's a public space. It's transparent. It's not about enclosure. It's not about privacy. It's about, I am being productive here with this tree, treating the tree not in the model that we've inherited. Again, the way that nature has been valued is through the environmental services model, this technocratic idea that we can put a number on the carbon sequestering and the stormwater retention and the shade and energy savings from the tree and the beautification and the, you know, this, the accounting sheets that is reduplicated across the economy, that that's how we value nature. And so in New York City, a tree is valued for 80 years of service at $400 and something. In London, an urban tree is valued at £460, a mature tree, for its replacement value. And that has no sense. I mean, imagine, you can't even do an Airbnb for a week for €460, right? It's just not consistent with the sense of value. The most recent tree office I did was in Shoreditch in London. And in addition to offering the service of the office space, it started offering the service of cloud data storage. Because most people don't understand that, you know, where all your Instagram images go and your Facebook posts is into the cloud. And that cloud data and internet services, as an industry, are more polluting than the entire airline industry. And it's doubling. It's the fastest growing sector of the digital economy. And everybody's giving away, you know, Apple cloud storage or Amazon or Dropbox or all of these services. And where is this cloud? You know, then no one has an idea of where that cloud is. So with the tree, Rupert in London, we developed the first tree cloud data storage, which runs the cloud solid state digital memory on an energy system that uses waste. So the cellulosic waste, the paper waste that's generated by the office, and the food waste, which are the two biggest waste streams in an urban context. So the idea, Rupert the tree did the first system where we used paper waste and food waste to generate clean energy and these co-benefits, because of course that's what the tree office is about. You know, what is it? What does a tree spend its money on, right? Well, how does a tree spend the profits? Of course, they would spend it in the interests of the tree. The first one that I did, there was 25 people paying $40 a month to have unlimited access to the tree office. So the tree was generating $1,000 a month. What does the tree do with $1,000 a month, right? Of course, it does things in its own interests, right? Biochar augmenting the soil around it, and sent three of its saplings off to college. So one went to Cornell, one went to Rutgers, one went to NYU. The one at NYU failed. But the tree cloud data service, which is powered by clean energy, is actually indexed to the leaf area index of the tree. So this idea that the cloud is everywhere, nowhere, and costless becomes grounded in the fact that there is, you know, energy that can be produced, but we can index it to whatever is meaningful. And Leaf Area Index turns out to be, I would argue, the most important measurable metric in the whole kind of smart city discourse, which is generating all sorts of big data, which effectively means nothing. I mean, have we learned anything from big data yet? We've learned that delivery trucks tend to have more accidents, slightly more accidents when they're turning left. Well, any truck driver could tell you that. But I would argue that there is one really good metric, and that's this metric of Leaf Area Index. Anyway, we know we don't need a lot of data to tell us how air quality is bad, right? But what we do need is data about how we can improve it and how well we can improve it. So we have one technology, one demonstrated technology for improving urban air quality, and that is leaves. We have a technology that can significantly improve human health and environmental health. It's a great proxy for biodiversity. This is not the same as counting trees and nicely spaced clonal trees decoratively planted along the street. That's nice, but it gives us no canopy complexity. It doesn't give us functioning ecosystems that support diverse organisms. But Leaf Area Index is a simple metric that we can hold cities accountable to. We can measure. It's already measured. Satellite LIDAR and terrestrial LIDAR that cities are doing across the world is already there. But no one's pulling the leaf area out of that and saying, you know, if you tenfold increase the leaf area index on that city block, you'll reduce the hospitalization of kids with asthma. You'll increase the cardiovascular health of every person in that street. No one's coupling those things together. So Tree Cloud Data is the initiative, the Environmental Health Clinic I'm hoping to launch here, with where we index the cloud data storage capacity to the Leaf Area Index in order to couple the fastest growing digital sector of the economy to the most significant human health indicator.
Golden spike of the Anthropocene.
We are the biggest biogeochemical forces on the planet. So we either throw up our hands and say, oh, what have we done? You know, we screwed up. Or this whole idea that we, the cultural moment that we've marked the Anthropocene and said, we recognize that it's no longer about the wild spaces and urban spaces that we kind of contain our damage, right? That we've far exceeded what we thought we were doing. You know, there's this big debate that's going on about the golden spike, that the International Geological Union is, where do we put the spike of the Anthropocene? Is it the beginning of agriculture? Is it the first nuclear tests? Is it, you know, the convention of marking geological eras with golden spikes? It's, I think, very sweet. But I've seized that golden spike, and I want to drive it in, not where there's some layer of gray in the snow where the Industrial Revolution started and the ice caps, but where we seize responsibility, where we say we have an ability to respond to the scientific knowledge of the nutrient cycles and the biogeochemical cycles that we can now describe. We can respond.
Mutualistic system design.
What characterizes my work is mutualistic systems design. And this was something that I only learned, you know, a couple of years ago, because I did do doctoral work in three different, in neuroscience, in history and philosophy of science, and in engineering. I mean, I studied evolutionary theory with some of the greats, right? Dick Lewontin and Peter Godfrey Smith. I mean, these are, I had never come across this idea that conservatively 95% of the world's biomass, all the forests, all the corals, all the meadows, all the flowers, all the pollinators, are constituted by that subset of symbiotic organisms we call mutualists. You know, I'd heard a lot about predator-prey relationships, competition for resources, survival of the fittest, which Darwin never said. That whole paradigm of how natural systems work, it's mutualists. These organisms that do better in each other's presence than not, right? That they live longer, they thrive, they reproduce more, they have a better time when they're in association. Not, just symbiotes who are living beside each other and putting up with each other and sharing the space, but are actively benefiting from each other. That's basically the world. At least 95% of the world's biomass organisms are mutualists. Why didn't I know that, right? Why was this Malthusian idea that you have, these population expansions and then collapses? No, you don't have to. It's not a zero-sum game, right? It's not a game theoretic, what you win, I lose, right? It's actually, we can design systems for mutual benefit. And that paradigm, if we translate it into the urban systems, I think it's very powerful and very under-theorized and very underdone. There's a lot of biomimetic design, and which is about taking the look or the surface or the, it's not actually how systems perform. Anyway, this idea that we can design mutually beneficial systems, and that of course should be what our urban infrastructure, that's what our data infrastructure, our energy infrastructure, our food systems can be reimagined and redesigned so that it's a mutualistic system, so that we're doing not cost-benefit analysis, but benefit-benefit analysis. That's the challenge I think we face. And for me, I've only recently articulated this as the design. But politically, again, it takes it out of traditional leftist, progressive, or regulatory, or libertarian, or anarcho, any of the old language of political organization, and into a kind of much more material, what is possible, what works. And natural systems are largely mutualistic systems. They work. So we can make urban systems and these socio-ecological systems mutualistic. That's, I think, the agency we have, the creative invitation, and the best hope I have for designing a delicious, biodiverse future.
Makba.cat.
Who or what is making the sense? Who or what does it make sense to, and why? This is what my colleagues and I and others who are engaging in this kind of issue are saying. If we can't be the ones who make sense of all of this, then we as artists, citizens and scientists are all in real trouble. So again, there is a unique stupidity about us as artists that can be incredibly useful in this context, that makes the artist a sort of lowest common denominator in relation to the institutions of science and technical ends. Natalie Jeremijenko in conversation with Benjamin Bratton in Suspicious Images, Latent Interfaces.